Hello, I'm Liam Harbison, and you're listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it, you've got to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the Breffni Early Show. Each week we try and bring you somebody who is interesting, inspirational and motivational, and I think we have managed to tick that box yet again this week. I am joined by the current CEO of Paralympics Ireland and the soon-to-be director of the Sport Ireland Institute, Mr. Liam Harbison. Liam, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Breffni, how are you?
I'm great. It must be said that we are friends. And we do know each other.
This is very awkward.
It's going to be fine. It's going to be absolutely fine. We have managed to spend a bit of time in each other's company over the last 10 or so years, particularly one Monday afternoon / morning, you might remember, in October 2011, where we both trudged around the streets in the Dublin City Marathon and managed to finally tick that box slightly.
Yeah, I dragged you around the streets that morning, if I remember right. That morning, nearly early evening by the time we finished, Breffni. Yeah,
it became almost early evening.
We better be fair to the listeners and say, well, actually, they'd taken down the finishing post by the time we got there.
No, the finishing post was still there, just the gantries and everything were gone.
There was no t-shirt left.
No, we didn't get a t-shirt. Although I think I got one posted out to me.
But in fairness, about 18 miles, I didn't think you were finishing, so fair play to you.
Thank you very much. Although I don't think I would have finished without your help. So there's a little bit of inspiration and motivation we were looking for. But anyway, let's get back to you and talk about... You're in the papers all the time when it comes to Paralympics. Over every 4 years, we were reading about what your athletes are doing. And that's one of the main things I want to talk about today is how you seem to have turned... how sport is treated within your organization kind of on its head, because in other organizations we hear about the CEOs a lot, we hear about the presidents, we hear about these people who are at the top table, but in Paralympics Ireland, where the names we hear are not your name or the president's name, they tend to be the Jason Smiths and the Michael McKillops and the Mark Rohans over the years, and the people who are on the podium, the people who are actually competing. And I think that's probably something we're going to come back to and speak about in a bit more detail later on. But first, let's rewind a little bit back to maybe your teenage years, and why did you get involved in sport first?
Why did I get involved in sport? I suppose, like most people, I just developed a love of sport, really, with my father, who was a sports mad. And when I was young, living in Portmarnock, a new sports centre was built, and my dad used to play basketball for Ireland many, many years ago. So I went up to his basketball training sessions, and one day there was a session for kids beforehand, and I went in and I took part. I loved it, and so started a lifetime, really, of sporting involvement. It was... wonderful times. I played most sports growing up. Played a lot of basketball, badminton, volleyball probably became pretty my best sport. I was all right at golf. Played Gaelic football in school. Only really played street football, soccer. I tried most things. I was handy at swimming as well. So there was always a very strong interest.
Were you one of those kind of kids growing up that was good at everything and annoyed everybody else who wasn't quite as good?
No, I wasn't. I was... competent at everything, but I wasn't great at anything, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I wasn't winning championships all over the place. You might see me on the second or third step on a podium rather than the top. The odd time I had some success, but fundamentally it was about participating. It was really the core values of taking part in sport as a young person. That's what I loved. I loved the camaraderie of team sports. I loved the straightforward single determination of individual sport. You know, just my life was occupied really by sport, and I suppose the school I went to, Portmarnock Community School, had a great sort of extracurricular program of sport. So I played sport every day in school, or I played in some team after school, and it took off that way. And I just always had an interest. And I suppose growing up, then I had sort of a weird ideas in my head, sort of going through secondary school, that I either wanted to be a PE teacher or an accountant. Don't ask me how.
They're probably the two most polar opposite.
Yes, they are very much so. I'm still can't quite figure out why I want to be
or
one
which,
of those two,
or which one.
Or
you
which
are.
One.
And then you have elements of a PE teacher and an accountant.
Yeah, yes. So at the end of, and I remember then between fifth and sixth year in school, I was on this sort of week long program in the University of Limerick. It was called an Introduction to University program. I was there with my other best mates at the time. We had a great week learning about different ideas. As I said, I had no idea really what I wanted to do in college. At that stage, there was hardly any places in PE and UL. Didn't really think. I was academically okay, but I wasn't like a super
UL
student.
UL at the time was 520 points.
But I learned about recreation management, which is a cross between sort of sports management, sports coaching, business. And it seemed to go. So that seemed to be where my interest went. The only place you could do it when I left school was in Waterford, RTC as it was in the time, WIT now. So I applied and on we went, and so began probably 4 years, probably some of the best 4 years of my life, away from home down in Waterford, and everybody in my class was away from home. We had an absolute ball.
It's funny because nowadays we hear sports science, we hear sports recreation, we hear leisure management. There's the whole country's awash with these kind of courses, and there is definite industry there now. The building we're sitting in today is Sport HQ here in the National Sports Campus, and there's jobs, real proper jobs in the industry. That wouldn't have been the case outside of a couple of sports 20 years ago.
Back then there was nothing. Sports science wasn't really, there was no real option for sports science in third level. Outside of PE was probably the only real opportunity, or else recreation management in Waterford. They had a leisure management course in DIT as well. They were really, and they only had a very small intake every year. But if I remember my first day in college, and sure, there was a big discussion in the class, there's no jobs at the end of this course. Like, and I was like, well, that's a great way to start your
very
third level studies, you know, and that was the time, that was the early 90s, and you know, things were different and tougher then. When I see what's available now and the amount of courses, the amount of people coming through, I hope there's jobs for all the people coming out of third level now and all the sports courses. There is huge opportunity, but also sport has professionalised in Ireland over the last, I would say, 15 years, really, with the Sports Council would have kicked it off probably the late 90s, and from then different sports bodies have developed professional staff structures. Like in Paralympics Ireland, we've 11 staff now. I was the first full-time staff member of Paralympics Ireland back in 2003. You know, so it's moved on across a whole range of sporting bodies, and sometimes sports bodies get bad press about how they're governed or how they're run. There's some incredible work being done in sports bodies, but what I would say is there's a general perception that it can't be difficult to run a sports body, but sport is something that everybody has an opinion in, everybody has a passion about, everybody has their own ideas. Sports administration is really, really challenging. When you bring in local politics, governing body politics, it really just adds a whole complex mix of relationship management you have to do to actually really survive in the business of sports administration.
Let's go back to leaving Waterford IT. You've had 4 great years. Where did you go from out of that? Was there a job for you at the end of it, straight out of college?
I actually, my first job out of college when I left in 96, I actually became sort of an instructor or a leader on a FOSS sports leadership course that was on actually in Portmarnock. I just did that for a year, didn't really like it. Teaching wasn't my thing, but it was a handy year, first year out of college, you know. And then I moved into the area of facility management, and I did have an interest in sort of leisure centres and swimming pools, and I worked in at the Arena Health and Fitness Club at the Grand Hotel in Malahide for about 5 years. But while all that was going on, that was what I was doing as my early profession. Yeah, that was a day job. But really, what really had me going, what I was really interested in, was I had developed this interest in the area of disability sport.
Now, why disability sport? Because, okay, it's all the rage now. We see the Paralympics everywhere, mainly down to you and your staff and your boards and your athletes' work over the last, particularly 8 years, probably since Beijing in 2008, things started to really take off on that front. But in terms of your contribution and why you decided you wanted to get involved in disability sport from coming through recreation management.
Yeah, well, I'll be honest, I didn't really have any interests when I went into college. But I remember between second and third year in college, I went to visit my sister who lived in Budapest. at the time, at 3 weeks over there. But we went on a trek, a horse trek, and I came off the horse the way you're not supposed to come off a horse, and I was badly injured. I basically was thrown off the horse, landed on the back of my neck. I lost pretty much all feeling from my neck down for about 2 or 3 hours. Scariest few hours of my life. I spent a bit of time in intensive care in a hospital in Budapest that day. And then I was, after a few hours, the pain just shot through me. It was the most horrible pain I've ever experienced. However, it was the most wonderful pain I've ever experienced, because I knew I was going to be all right. So eventually, through a range of investigations, very difficult with the language barrier. This was early 90s in
Hungary, you know, to scratch it up.
In Hungary. I'm not going to go there. And so it was a frightening time as a 19-year-old. But it took me a good... When I came home, I got checked out again. I had broken no vertebrae, but I had done major damage to sort of all my ligaments, tendons, and down my spinal column. And really, I spent the best part of, I suppose, 3 or 4 months where I had no, I wasn't able to twist my trunk. And it was probably about 10 months before I was able to jog again. But in all that time, I sort of looked at the area of sport as a means of rehab, and the role that sport plays in the lives of people with disabilities, where they do take part. So my study sort of went down the sort of therapeutic recreation route, and I did a study into the effect of active sports participation on life satisfaction and self-esteem for people with cerebral palsy. So I developed a lot of interest. So once I came through my college years, I wanted to sort of get involved and give something back. And I had used a lady called Brenda Green, who would have been the founder of Cerebral Palsy Sport Ireland, Cerebral Palsy Sport Ireland, no longer with us. But she had given me a lot of help and gave me access to people who would be my control group or my test group in terms of my studies. And I got involved with her, and they had this club every Thursday in the old Cerebral Palsy Ireland Centre, now in Able Ireland, in Sandymount. And I used to go along every Thursday and just do some sports with the kids. It could be basketball, volleyball, soccer, whatever. But it was a real great sort of club atmosphere. And I remember then they were the national governing body for cerebral palsy sports. And the following year they said, listen, would you go as a helper with the boccia team to the European Championships? And my first answer was yes. And my second answer is, what's boccia?
Yeah, yeah.
And so they told me. So basically about 2 months later then.
Well, you better tell us what boccia is then.
Well, boccia is a form of bowls for those with severe levels of cerebral palsy. However, it's moved on to other disability groups as well with similar severity of boccia at paralympic level. But it's a sport that everybody can play.
Able-bodied can play with disabled.
Yeah, but at paralympic level, it's certain eligibility criteria. But it's a wonderful, wonderful game. A lot of strategy involved. And I remember going to the airport, and there was six players and there was five staff, and I didn't know any of them. I was quite young, and so I was like, hey, I'll see how this goes. And I remember on the way from the airport in Bilbao to the hotel in Vitoria in northern Spain, I was basically handed a letter from one of the other staff, and basically I opened it, and it was a letter from Brenda Green. It basically said, by the way, I didn't want to tell you until you went, but you're the team manager.
Lovely.
So that's how I was appointed the team manager. I was like, oh Lord, and I knew nothing about the game. Just, I hadn't really seen it. I'd seen the lads play a game or two when they trained before they went. But over the course of the next 4 or 5 days, I realised that it was an amazing game. B, in Ireland, we had a group of athletes, if they got the right support, could be phenomenal at the game. And see, then we had people who were there with us who wanted to develop. They had no real structure or no real program. So what happened before that, anybody who played the sport would meet maybe 2 months before a European or World Championships. They'd have a little competition, and the winners would be sent to represent Ireland.
Yeah.
And then there would be no more boccia then until the same happened year. The following year.
Yeah.
So I came back, and the guy I shared a room with, a guy called Liam Bracken, he was really strong on the area of sort of logistics and wheelchair setup and everything. I was very interested in the area of training and adapting training principles from other sports and really looking and learning the strategy of the game from other countries. And we came back and we put a plan in place. We went to the CPSI committee, said we'd like to give this a try, and we got a bit of a okay, we'll try it. It's been tried before. It doesn't really work. I said, no, we're really going to go for it. So we set about recruiting some volunteers. Generally, it was wives and girlfriends, and it was, you know, people who were...
Parents.
And I basically got a list. Anybody who'd ever played the sport of bocce in Ireland, ever. I think there was 30 people on the list. I wrote to them all and said, we're starting this. We hired a hall. It was the old Boylan's entrance on Leary. It wasn't in great shape, but it did for us. But we
How many people showed up that day?
First day, 19 showed up.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Normally, these stories start with three people showed up.
It was phenomenal. But again, it was a sign of the times that the guys that showed up and girls that showed up, generally, they had that sort of institutional mindset. And they came sort of in jeans and boots and big duffel coats. And it was wintertime. And we were saying, listen, guys, we're going to treat this as a sport. We're going to treat you guys as athletes. So we want to see tracksuits. We want to see water bottles. We're going to work you. We're going to do some. Although you're very limited in terms of your physical ability, what you do have, we are going to work. And over the course of the first, we met basically, the guys came up to the country on a Friday night. We put them up in a local home. We trained pretty much all day Saturday, 9 to 5. Do skills and stuff in the morning, play sort of matches in the afternoon. And over the course of the next 2 months, the people who were just there filling time where we felt we were sort of nearly babysitting, they drifted away and it got very serious. And we had agreed with the committee that if we're going to do this, we're going to send the full team to the World Championships the following June in New York. And that was the carrot. And we worked away. Great team spirit built. We really, really worked hard as a group. But I think for the first time, those athletes realized that there was a group of people who really believed in them and supported them and wanted them to succeed and develop in their sport. So we went to New York in 98, big team, and not expecting a huge amount, still very early doors for the program. And we came away. Suddenly, the guys who were losing all their pool matches were winning one or two. And a couple of guys got through the pools into the last 16. And I think two got to the last eight, and from that one, Johnny Croner from Cork got into the last four. And basically lost the semi-final, but won the third and fourth. We had a bronze medal. Now, John Croner plays with a ramp. Anybody who knows him, he's an amazing character, but very committed to his sport. And part of what was, I think, of how antiquated it was, the previous year when I first met John, and the first time Ireland had sort of ramp players in the bocce championships, they were using a waven pipe as their ramp.
Facilities were a bit lacking.
Oh, well, we didn't know. So it was all the other teams with these high-tech ramps. So over the course of the next year, we developed and built new ones whenever. But John went on and won a bronze medal at the World Championships. But the lift that gave to everybody, and even people like Gabriel Shelley, who was ranked sort of 45th in the world, he got up to the mid-20s. That you just see everybody just up their game.
It's a rising tide, though. It carries everybody kind of sees, well, if he can do it, I can do it.
And so suddenly we started having a bit of success. So CPSI had said, listen, try and we'd like to qualify for the Paralympic Games in Sydney. Now, to qualify for the Paralympic Games in Sydney, you have to be ranked in the top 12 in the BC1, BC2 team competition and top 8 in the BC3 ramp competition. And going in after the World Championship then in 1998, we were ranked, I think we were 21st in the team, and I think we were 17th in the pair. So we had no chance. So we went to the World Cup, we carried on, we put loads more supports in place, got more help, brought in a bit of physiology support from Caroline McManus, who was now works in the Institute, and we started engaging Dr. Alan Ringland, sports psychologist, to give some extra support to the team. So we went to the World Cup in the following year in Mar del Plata, the final qualifier. Sorry, Mar del Plata is in Argentina, the final qualifier for Sydney. And what happened that week was just incredible. We had a horrendous journey over. The organizing committee left us at the airport in Buenos Aires waiting for a bus to Mar del Plata for 17 hours.
Wow.
And then we had a 6-hour journey. So we arrived at 5 in the morning, the day of the opening ceremony. It was just disaster.
Yeah, that's not, but we put not in, ideal we, preparation.
No, we dealt with it and we got on with it and we put a plan in place. But what happened over the next 5 or 6 days, I'll never forget. So like in the BC1 competition, Gay Shelley won a silver medal. Phenomenal. But beaten by a pure fluke with the last ball by Henrik Jorgensen from Denmark. In BC2, Tom Leahy got to the quarterfinal. It was wonderful. BC3, Johnny Cronin got the silver medal. And in BC4, Aaron Hassan won the gold medal. It was crazy. And the World Cup is based on points of every competition, every match, every game contributed to your country's points total. But the qualifier for the Paralympic Games is based on the team and the pair. So we started that competition and the pair had a shocking draw against the current world champions and then the Paralympic champions. So we were thinking, no chance here. They just absolutely destroyed them all. So we got team and pair through the group stages into quarterfinals, through the quarterfinals. So both were in the semifinals. And oh my God, we have a chance here. And the big strong nations then was Spain and Portugal. And no one ever beats Spain and Portugal. So in the team, we had Portugal in the semifinal. And the pair of the guys had Spain. And in the semifinal, we beat them 6-2. But it was amazing. The whole Boccia community were sort of, oh my God, Portugal are getting beaten. And the support we got was phenomenal. Because we came out of nowhere.
Anyone but the best team.
But it was, the guys in the pair happened to beat Spain as well. So suddenly both teams are in the final. Now, unfortunately, we lost both finals. But I remember the night at the closing banquet, they were announcing the rankings. We still didn't think, we thought the team, we think pretty sure we had enough to qualify. The pair, we still think we had no chance. When they called out the rankings that night, went down from 1 all the way to 15. And in the team, they announced 1, 2, and third ranked in the world, Ireland. I was like, wow, how'd that happen? And then they came to the pair, ranked 5th, Ireland. We're like, wow. So both teams have qualified for the Paralympic Games. It was incredible, incredible. And we came 2nd in the World Cup. Like, it was just from a team that were nowhere 2 years before, suddenly we were the second best team in the world. So we carried on to the Paralympic Games in Sydney. Again, got more support, got more help, got more people in. Yeah, the fact that we're going to be away for nearly a month created some difficulties because obviously we were all volunteers and getting time off work became a challenge. We went to Sydney with a good hope, and Sydney, again, was just one of those competitions where we just, the group of players we had and the staff, they just delivered. They focused solely on the Boccia competition, didn't really worry what was going on around. And when you go to a Paralympic Games, there's so much distraction around you. And by the end of the Boccia competition in Sydney, the number one team, number one nation on the medals table in Boccia was Ireland, and that was...
That's phenomenal. Just
the way it was. I'll never forget it. And the memories I'll never lose. And some amazing little stories in that. But again, it was an amazing journey. But a journey that included so many people who all contributed in so many ways. And I know anybody who was part of that program at the time, I know we'll never forget what we did. It was pretty special what we did as a group of people. With no real support, no real resource. We just... got our hands dirty and got on with it ourselves.
Before we go off the subject of, you mentioned BC1, BC2, BC3, BC4. Can you briefly tell us what that is? I know it's classification, but just for the listeners who are not familiar with what that means.
Basically, within Paralympic sports, you have minimal eligibility criteria to take part in any particular sport. And then within the sport, you may have different categories. And the categories are basically to ensure that there's fairness of competition. So... like you wouldn't have a lightweight boxer boxing a heavyweight. Or you wouldn't have a lightweight rower against a heavyweight rower. It's basically like categories within the sport. So different levels of physical impairment in that case. But different. So in other words, it's like, for example, in athletics now, Michael McKillop doesn't compete against Jason Smith. Cause Michael McKillop is an athlete with cerebral palsy, which is a muscle impairment. Where Jason Smith has vision impairments, so that you're not comparing like with like. So it's basically categorizing athletes into the categories. They're only competing against people with similar levels of impairment as themselves.
Okay. A couple of years after that, you spotted the role of performance director of Paralympics Ireland. As you said, no professional staff in the organization. You had this phenomenal success in Sydney, and you put your name in the hat for that gig.
Well, there was a part-time staff member in Paralympic Council of Ireland at the time, a lady called Anne Ebbs, who is still on the board to this day, an amazing woman who really put Paralympic sport on the map in Ireland with other people. But fundamentally, I think it was down to Anne's vision, drive, determination. And really, it was because of her work and others that when the Sydney Review came out of the Olympic and Paralympic Games, and there was a high-performance strategy, suddenly Paralympic sport were getting some level of parity with Olympic sport. So Paralympic athletes were included in the carding scheme. So when there was five positions for performance director created in Irish sport, one was given to the Paralympic Council. So when they applied, when they posted their ads, I saw it, had a look, and it's like every you see a job in the paper, you go, oh, sure, I'll never get that. But you look through the requirements, and I seemed to tick most of the boxes, so I threw my hat in the ring. At that stage, I was working assistant manager in the Arena Health Club. I was happy enough, but it was open to a change. And I did feel, though, going through the journey to Sydney, I did feel that the structure of the Irish team could have been improved. I did feel, at that stage, Paralympic Council, their remit was coordination, it wasn't performance. But the high-performance strategy meant they changed their remit to performance. I did feel they really supported athletes, put in athlete support services, give them greater sports science support, develop their coaches, develop the leadership around them. They could make huge improvements in terms of performance for Paralympic athletes at future Paralympic Games. So I saw the job, I applied, went through a process, and I was offered the position. It was a bit surprised, but I got it, and we started in January 2003, and pretty much a blank canvas. It hadn't been done before. I remember my first day. We had no office at the time. Anne used her house as the office for Paralympic Council. And I met the president, Tony Guest, and Anne Ebbs in Anne's house. And so it was the first day. And they said, oh, it's great to see you. And there's your laptop and there's your phone. And off you go. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, we don't know. I said, okay. So we really were starting from absolute scratch. And they said, you did a presentation at the interview where you laid out a 2-year plan of what could be done.
Do that.
And we set off and we started on a journey that has brought us to some wonderful places.
Well, obviously Athens came in 2004. That would have been the first games, but really only a year into that program. I think, as I mentioned earlier, Beijing was where Paralympic sport seemed to really catch the imagination of the Irish community.
I wouldn't write off Athens. There was very little we could do, but what we did have was a very, very, very small budget. And there was a program called the Athens Enhancement Program. So we focused on six specific athletes. We really worked with their coaches and their NGB around what could we do more for these six athletes. And of those six, four won medals. So it was a decent return. But I never really felt we could really make an impact until Beijing. So the first focus was very much on a few athletes for Athens. And then we really looked around sports science and medical support and coaching support in the build-up to Beijing. But all the while, we were trying to build resource, trying to get support, trying to build the investment from the Irish Sports Council, which was challenging. But it was the Celtic Tiger era. So there were increments coming year on year. And I think what we've always done is we always spent our money well. We always tried to prioritize where I would spend, but always try and bring the wider Paralympic family together. So we would try and raise all boats together. And Beijing was... It was a wonderful games, and that was probably the first games where there was large crowds of Paralympic Games. Fair enough, they may have been...
Shipped in.
A bit of a renter crowd, yeah. But they were there. They made plenty of noise.
How much of the Irish success was down to the breakthrough of the two guys we mentioned earlier, Jason Smith and Michael McKillop? Or were they just kind of a result of the process?
Well, there's no question Michael and Jason have been enormous for Paralympic sport in Ireland for 10, 12 years now. But I think the success... is not solely down to Michael and Jake. There's other people there in the background. Like, athletes who were coming towards the end could see that there was changes being made. And what I always love about Paralympic athletes, I think they have a real sense of responsibility and sort of obligation and a desire that their journey to Paralympic sport was very difficult. All the barriers had to overcome, not just because of their impairment, because of the system barriers, access to venues, transport, getting coaching support. And they're determined to pass on the lessons they've learned. And they also, I really love watching them with young kids with disabilities. Because you know what? When I was growing up, my role model was Bernhard Langer. He was a golfer from Germany. I just admired him. Or if I liked football, at the time it was someone like Paul McGrath, or go back earlier with some like Norman Whiteside. You know, these guys aren't...
Yeah, we're getting closer to your vintage now.
Exactly. Yeah, but for somebody with a young kid with a disability, what Beijing provided was an opportunity that they had role models that were people with who are athletes, but athletes who happen to have an impairment. So what Beijing did was suddenly there was, I suppose, in a roundabout way, I think a lot of the coverage and the exposure Paralympic sport got in Ireland was because of a controversy in Beijing, which is around a classification issue we had with one super athlete we had.
Was it football?
Yeah, Derek Malone. And so the powers that be decided that Derek, in simple terms, they felt he wasn't disabled enough to be on the football team. Now, we protested like mad over there. We really worked hard to make the point that this guy had won a bronze medal in athletics in 2004 in the same class that the class 8s in football have, and same as CP Sport in 2008. How could he not be impaired enough? And we fought that at the time. It was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do in my life. Was after his first match against Iran, I was brought in by the classification team and told, your player is out. He's ineligible, cannot compete in the rest of the games. So I remember having to go in and find Derek, sit down and tell him. And it was very hard to do. I was, listen, let's try and do what we can to support you and help you. And we did. Went on a bit of an attack in the media to really put pressure on the International Federation, which was CP ISRA. Over the course of the next week or two, there was no sign of any outcome. But while there was huge controversy, remember it was front page news and it was covered around the world in many respects. It was a year later we actually got the decision overturned through going through all the various processes. Of course, that was hardly
too
reported.
Late. Yeah.
But it was a victory nonetheless. But I really think Derek was absolutely cheated. He was probably our model athlete in terms of how he prepared, how he looked after himself. And the view that he wasn't impaired enough, to him, in my view, was absolute rubbish. What happened was he trained himself to a point where he was able to manage the symptoms of his impairment, whereby it had as little impact as possible on his ability to perform on the field of play. In other words, the athletes and their athlete preparation had nearly gone past and overtaken the science that determines the classification system. But it's moved on a lot since then, but that was very, very good. But again, a lot of the coverage around that, when people were going, what's that? And suddenly we were getting interviewed with all sorts of pieces around classification and Paralympic sport. And then, of course, Jason won 2 gold medals, similar to what Usain Bolt did. So it was a handy line, oh, the Usain Bolt, the Paralympic Games. Michael McKillop won an amazing gold medal in the Bird's Nest in front of 80,000 people.
And setting world records each time.
Provided
they did the
great, track. Great images of Irish success on world podiums. And then from that, then, that gave us a launch pad. We knew London was coming 4 years later. And I suppose the focus of the whole organisation was geared towards London. A lot of athletes wanted to stay involved until London, and because it was going to be a home games, we'd probably never have this experience again. But yeah, it was
until the new Institute of Sport are going to say we're going to host it in Dublin in 20 years' time.
Well, let's be realistic. The Olympic Games and Paralympic Games will never be in Ireland. Okay, we simply have not got the scope or the infrastructure. I'm not saying we don't have the will or the ability, but it's anybody who's been to Olympic or Paralympic Games will understand the magnitude of the Games in terms of infrastructure requirements, and it's not something a nation the size of Ireland will ever have. And that's not being critical, that's just being
I think that's a realistic view of the whole thing. Let's move on, because from 2008, obviously, that put a great level in 2008 to build on, particularly with the attraction of the home Games, as you mentioned. And the largest Paralympic team, I could be wrong on this, but the largest Paralympic team of all time went to London with you as the chef de mission. How much of an honour was that on a personal level? Yeah, or were you more worried about the logistics of what you had to do in that role?
It was an honour. I mean, it was probably the biggest honour of my life, to lead an Irish team at a home Games in London where we had incredible success. Reflecting on it now, it was amazing. At the time, I was just too in it and too busy. Like, I was made CEO. I started the CEO job 2 weeks after Beijing. And I think it was, at the time, it was the right decision to make the CEO the chef de mission, because it provided better accountability of the team through the organization, through the board, the president, etc. But we weren't to project how big the Paralympic Games would become between Beijing and London.
Is that in Ireland or international?
Well, globally. And it just created enormous pressure in terms of the requirement to get resource, to apply the resource a certain way, demands on the team, trying to soak up and benefit from every opportunity to build the education program, to build other awareness programs, to get greater engagement with the media, to really push and develop a stronger sports science and medical program that really supports athletes, to build leadership capacity of the coaches and team leaders in support. There were so many components to it, while at the same time looking at the governance of our organization and actually running and managing a national governing body in Ireland. You know, there was so much going on over those 3 or 4 years. But I have to say, though, I remember the day of the...
You still had time to run a marathon.
I did, but I ran the marathon to raise money for Paralympics Ireland. No disrespect, Breffni.
What? You didn't do, well, you didn't do it for me?
One thing I would also say is running the marathon might be just stretching it a bit.
Okay, completing a marathon.
We completed the course.
Yeah, sorry.
On our own 2 feet.
I digressed again.
But no, like London, though, was absolutely phenomenal. I think anybody who had part of that experience, and I think for the athletes on the team, the huge recognition, the build-up, huge media coverage, there was huge hype. I think the fact the Olympic team did so well in London, people wanted more and they engaged more. And we had a sort of a registration system whereby family and friends of the athletes going, we would register them. We had a team facility that they had access to, our sponsors put together for us.
I was there.
It was a team lodge, and we had those rest areas for people. There's a play area for kids. And the idea being, if someone's going to a session in the pool in the morning, and the tickets for the evening, that they had somewhere to go during the day, and we could try and garner this community. But we had over 2,500 people registered for this facility, and then anytime somebody won a medal, we'd have a recognition event, and the organization would recognize what they did, and we'd interview them. It was just the camaraderie, the spirit, the community, and the Irish community in London were phenomenal. And we had worked very hard with LOCOG in the build up for 2 years. Listen, to maximize the opportunity, so they had a LOCOG Irish business group that we engaged very heavily with, and they wanted to be involved. So we gave them a couple of tasks. A was to help us with this facility. B is get an Irish crowd at the games. But C, I want you to coordinate sort of an Irish community event at the end of the games to honour the team and honour the whole London process. But we'd noticed on the schedule that came out a year before the games that on the first Saturday night of the games, September the 1st, 2012, within an hour of each other, Jason Smith and Michael McKillop will be defending their gold medals. At this stage, they're both had been beaten since Beijing. So we had targeted. So we said to people, if they had any latent interest in Paralympic sport or going to the games, try and go to that session.
That was the day I got tickets for. Try and go on to your advice.
And what happened over the following year, so we also, Paralympic sport, we knew there'd be a demand as the game started for us. We bought loads of tickets to sell on as well. And we estimate that night what was great, there was no real British athlete in contention that night. So it became like an Irish night in the stadium. So you had 80,000 people. And we'd estimate...
Irish and Oscar.
Yeah.
Oscar ran that night as well.
We'd estimate that there was anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 Irish people in the stadium that night. And the atmosphere was just phenomenal. So the session started. So the second race was Jason Smith wins gold. And we're like, wow. So then he has his victory ceremony, and then like the next race is Michael McKillop, and he goes and he wins gold, and then Oscar races in the meantime, and then Michael is a victor. So we literally had 2 hours of being enthralled, and it really struck me when they were calling out the athletes one by one at the start of the race. You'd always get a cheer for every athlete. When they called out Jason Smith, the place went crazy, and you could actually see Jason physically when you on the screen. You could see like he was sort of a bit taken aback by it, and then it was just... It was one of those just amazing nights. And what people don't like, literally an hour before that, Darren McDonald had won a gold medal
in the pool
as well. So that night, Ireland won 3 gold medals across 2 hours at the Paralympic Games. Probably one of the greatest nights in Irish Paralympic sport.
But Irish sport, period. There's not too many major sports events where Ireland has had that. Yeah. Like, okay, we've had maybe, and not to put it down, but you take something like the transplant games or one of those kind of smaller games where they tend to be a smaller pool of athletes. But this is a major world event. Yeah. and a little country in the little in the northwest east Atlantic has basically come up with three fantastic performances.
I remember watching late that night, and there's a TV in the office. We're back in the office about 11 o'clock, half 11. And they threw up the medal table at the end of the program on Channel 4. Ireland was lying eighth position after 3 days. Like, four gold medals, no silver, no bronze. We're like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like, you know, it was like, our target was to try and get up to the top 30. We were 36th in Beijing, tried to get to the top 30, but there's way more countries involved than there was in Beijing. And that just set a momentum and set an interest and awareness, and the whole team just pushed on. And then later in the week, Michael won again on the Monday, and his mother presented the medal. Another amazing moment, iconic moment of the games. And that was before we even got to Brands Hatch and what Mark Roan did. Two incredible gold medals. I'll never forget that first day in Brands Hatch, looking down the home straight, and literally it was just bedecked with Irish flags and Irish people. I think the whole of the village of Ballinahound had travelled to Brands Hatch, and Mark delivered, and it was just... And it was just one of those games. We came home and we just... That was phenomenal. How do we repeat that? How do we go on from here?
How did you repeat that? Now, because we have a standing joke, yourself, myself, and another friend.
Be careful.
about how your job consists of 4 years' holidays followed by a month of actual holidays. I think anyone who's listening to the show will realize that it's very different to that kind of...
I can assure you, Refni, it's very different.
Yeah.
You're presenting it.
Yeah.
But
you do put in an awful lot of work between the Paralympic Games, and then that's what takes up the kind of the media inches, the column inches in the newspapers and any conversations all around the games.
What we haven't touched on is that the small incremental steps that as an organisation that we took from 2004 right up to today. So like what Beijing did for us, with three gold medals, like images of Irish athletes in the green jersey and Aaron Levine playing in foreign fields are very powerful. So that brought more support to us. So as CEO, we needed to recruit more staff. We needed to get funding to recruit more staff. Sports Council came on board, government support. This is now in the height of the recession. We were getting additional support when the economy was floundering and people were getting cutbacks everywhere because our guys were delivering time and time and time again. So we got more staff. We invested more in coach support, coach development. We know for now, I think one of our big successes was our sports science and medical program, whereas we would appoint providers centrally, and all the Paralympic sports and all the athletes would access to them. But those providers would travel to training camps and World Championships and European Championships throughout the 4 years. So those relationships and the knowledge, the athlete knowledge and the knowledge of the providers in the build-up to the games are actually there, the service about providing the service at the games themselves. And it's a seamless transition. So there were simple things that we did that were different, with huge programs around trying to develop awareness, trying to get media organizations on board. And I think the fruits of that were seen in Rio because the coverage is fantastic. There was 30 hours coverage on RTE TV. So there are all the little steps. And then behind that, then we had the whole commercial program, which was trying to engage third-party commercial support to support what it is we were trying to do. And so there's various different elements of the organization that we're all moving, taking small steps all the time, really to bring us where to be. So certainly I don't take credit for that. This was very much a group of people who all worked closely together, following a plan to bring us to where we are today. And I have no doubt that, would I have been able to do it on my own? Absolutely not. Did I do it on my own? Absolutely not. Do I give credit to myself? No. I give it to everybody who's been involved, from the presidents, the board members, to all the staff we've had. They've all played their part. And that goes down to people working in the governing bodies, the coaches, but also the athletes and their drive and determination and the families that support them.
In terms of Rio, which you mentioned, now, the setting coming into Rio this year could not have been more difficult for you and for the Paralympics Ireland and for the team on a couple of fronts. One was everything seemed to be in absolute chaos in Rio in terms of the finances, particularly around the games and the logistics. But then from an Irish point of view, 6 weeks earlier, we had failed drugs tests. We had the
Olympics now.
I'm aware. Yeah. But in people's perceptions, it's the Irish at these games. And you're facing into trying to sell this to the corporate market, trying to sell it to the supporters, trying to sell it maybe even to the teams themselves. How do you manage to kind of push all that stuff in the papers? Because it was everywhere. Like, Pat Hickey's name was everywhere. Michael Riley's name was everywhere. How do you deal with that? Did you have any tickets for any of the events?
You get me in trouble, I hear. But I think, though, everything was in place for us before all that happened. And I think the key for us is that the relationships we built with our supporters, whether they be commercial supporters, state agencies, or NGBs, people were bought into what it is we do in Paralympics Ireland, what we are about. You talked earlier about we put the athletes forward. We want to see the athletes front and centre. We don't want to have celebrity ambassadors or endorsers. We don't want to have the CEO or the president. That's not what we're about. We're very clear that we push the athletes centre forward. They should be the stars of our movement and our organisation. And they've proven that time and time again. But when all the build-up to Rio, I'd have to say, is I describe it that we had 4 years planning, and we actually then had a week to make a new plan. Because when the funding cuts were announced, it was, oh my God. My initial response was relief, because at least the games are going to happen. Because there was a bit of talk. My view on that is, though, it would have been more costly to cancel the games than it would to run the games. At the same time, we were very lucky. It was announced on a Friday afternoon, and I have to put my hats off now to the officials in the Department of Transport, Tourism and Sport. I was on the phone to them within an hour. This is where we are. This is what I think is the impact. The travel support grant, we're going to be stuck. It's going to impact here and here. We have initial information on the service levels that Rio were not going to provide that could potentially impact on our ability to service and support the athletes. And I have to say, within 24 hours, we had a very clear statement from the Ministers for Sport saying that they will ensure that the preparation for the Irish Paralympic team would not be impacted in any way, including financial. And that gave us great relief and great solace that we could go and put in the extra. So, for example, three areas that I was really concerned about was we had cars for the team provided by the organising committee, but with the funding cutbacks, they fired all the drivers and all the volunteers. So now we had cars, but no drivers. But we had to have...
Could you hire your own drivers?
Well, we had to. But we had to hire professional drivers at a cost. In Brazil at a huge cost. There was an issue around accommodation, so we're now suddenly short loads of accommodation. I had to go and find, I think I had to find 8 bedrooms for people who were coming a few days later. Very hard to do in a city that's got thousands of people coming in.
Yeah.
And then when we got to the village, and in fact, I have to say now, like our chef de mission, Dennis Toomey, and two of our NPC assistants who are staff of Paralympics Ireland, Lindsay Rankin and Anna Mayer, between the three of them and myself, we spent the first 3 days cleaning. And we scrubbed the village because
I saw the videos.
It was horrendous. But that's what National Paralympic Committee staff in every country did for those few days before the athletes. We were determined to make sure the experience for the athletes was not impacted because of financial issues of the organising committee. So there was doom and gloom, and they'd reported only 300,000 tickets were sold at that stage. And we're like, oh, this is going to be terrible. A huge step backward for the movement after London. But what happened over the following weeks, though, was the local Brazilian population realised what was happening. They started going to the games. They got connected with the athletes. They were wowed by the performances of the athletes. How could they have such incredible athletic achievement and athletic performance capability despite whatever level of impairment they have? And by the end of the games, I think 2.2 million tickets were sold. Most of the venues were pretty full. I would say the attendance in terms of occupancy at events was significantly higher than the Olympic Games. And there were moments during the games where people said, oh, wow, this is London. This is London. And that was a huge compliment to pay to Rio 2016. And I think when I reflect back now, having had a hugely difficult build-up to the games with major, major challenges, that as a group of people, our staff, our sponsors, the department, the agencies, we overcame, I think, together. I think fundamentally, I think the Paralympic movement didn't take that feared step backwards. And in fact, have taken another step forward, whereby we'll move forward to Tokyo 2020 with huge confidence that the movement will take further strides forward.
You say we will move forward, but that we won't specifically include you, because you're after landing yourself this nice plum job with a nice big promotion and a nice big paycheck.
I decided, like, I've been, like, I absolutely love Paralympic sport and I love Paralympics Ireland and I love everything about the organisation and the movement worldwide, and I've great friends and colleagues in Ireland and around the world. But I also do feel that I don't think I can, me personally, can take Paralympics Ireland anywhere else. And it needs, I think, a fresh set of eyes and fresh leadership. At the same time, the opportunity around the Sport Ireland Institute, following Gary Keegan, who's done a great job, and it's a guy I admire greatly, and I'm good. I've had good relationships.
You'd have a good working relationship.
Yeah, well, Gary, I mentioned that five performance directors that were appointed back in 2002. Well, Gary was one of them, and I was another. And there was three others. And so it's certainly going to be very challenging going in there. I saw the role advertised, and I do feel, opportunities don't come along that often at the top level of Irish sport. So I threw my hat in the ring, went through the process, and I was offered the position. And I must say, the few days from the offer to the acceptance was some of the most difficult days of my life, because I had to...
Who did you speak to, other than close family? Who did you actually say, can I get a bit of advice on this? Or did you?
I'm not going to name names, but I would have spoken to, I'd say...
Would Gary Keegan have been one of them?
No, because Gary was actually in Australia. And I wouldn't want to put Gary in that position. I was more, to be honest, my decision wasn't so much about accepting the role in the Institute. For me, the decision was leaving Paralympics Ireland. You know, it was an emotional wrench to leave something that I felt I'd been part of building up. It's been very good to me. I have great friendships. I think we're a fabulous organization, extremely well governed. And yet, it was just making that leap. You know, I've been to five Paralympic Games. Of course, I'd like to go to more Paralympic Games. They're wonderful events. But I also think I had to think of myself and my family and my own career, and I felt that I needed to make a change. I felt if I did another 4 years, and that could lead to another 4 years, you know, I'd maybe go stale. And
the right opportunity might not be available.
I'm not going to say I'm going to make an absolutely five-star success at the Institute job, because I don't know. But I certainly give it my all and give it my best. And I have good relationships with many of the people who work in the Institute. I have good relationships with many of the national governing bodies, with Sport Ireland. And I think I'd certainly... I hope I'll bring my... I think some of the challenges will obviously be is managing limited budget, as in all Irish sports, to try and provide best services. And I think everybody in Ireland believes that, or everybody in sort of sports bodies in Ireland, they all believe that their sport should get more support or more service. And I think part of the challenge we have is really prioritising where the support and the investment should go to get best return in performance terms for Ireland. So there'll be some challenges around working with the NGBs, who may or may not have a perception of where they actually fit in the bigger picture. I'll obviously have to be working with a range of different professional service groups, different service providers and disciplines, who may all have different views about where they should sit in the pecking order. I'll obviously have to work with the existing staff and providers in the Institute, who some I know and many I don't. So obviously I'll have to build a relationship with those people. But fundamentally, it's about driving support services and driving and improving, developing athlete performance going forward to Tokyo and beyond. It's a huge challenge. I don't see myself radically changing anything. But I'm sure in time I'll spot things that maybe we could try a bit different. But until I'm in there and really, really into it, I can't really give any more detail on that for the moment.
Let's look at the last 6 months in sport. The Paralympics that you've been involved in was hugely successful, achieved your goals and your targets in terms of medals at the Games, despite all the issues that were going on with funding. And the Olympic team probably didn't, I think it's fair to say. A lot of expectation, particularly in the boxing ring, that maybe didn't quite come. I don't lay it all on the head of the boxers, but they didn't deliver on at least the expectation. Your role in Paralympics Ireland, for the most part, has been a little bit under the radar. This isn't going to be quite so outside of the public view, because you're going to get referenced a lot more. The Institute is more high profile in terms of the top, top athletes. Does that faze you?
Well, certainly the public nature of, potentially public nature of the job is an area that concerned me when I was considering whether I would accept it or not. I'm generally, I'm innately a private person, as you know. I've known you for 10 years, but you've discovered stuff about me today that you never knew.
That's true.
I think by doing
it... Well, your height was always a giveaway about the basketball thing. I'm not going to lie. For the listeners who can't see him, Liam is absolutely huge. He's very, very tall.
I am not. You're some boyo. Like you referenced how that we've always pushed the athletes forward, and it's not me or the staff in Paralympics Ireland or the out there in the public eye. I think by doing a good job in the Institute, I think athlete performance will be the ones that we should be putting out. They're the ones that hopefully will show that the service and what we're producing in the Institute are what will be recognised. I'm not one to be wanting to be in the media or in the papers. It's just not my nature. But at the same time, there will be times maybe when I will have to become front and centre. At the same time, the Institute is part of Sport Ireland, and I will report to a CEO, who's John Tracy. I am accountable. I'll have to report in what's happening in the Institute into John and his colleagues on the council. What's success in the Institute? I think it's basically providing services that requires the level of service that's required, trying to build the capacity of the Institute, hopefully build the budget so we can get more service, really working with the providers in there, to secure their services and try and develop their roles and develop them professionally as well. And obviously then trying to work closely with the NGBs to make sure they feel part of what is actually happening at the Institute, with ultimately which are their athletes.
In terms of your tenure in the job, in 5 years' time, what will you see as success? Is it medals? Is it athletes' performances being better? Is it finances?
The Institute will have a budget. What that budget actually is will probably be as much down to John Tracy and government as anything else. My job will be to utilise that budget, whatever it may be, and prioritise the areas that are going to bring maximum return for Ireland. So I think it's in continuing improved performance of Irish athletes across a range of sports. It's also working with the sports to make sure the next level, the junior and development athletes, are coming through and getting the support service they need at the age they need them. So it's building wider capacity that ultimately will hopefully lead to greater performance at world events or European events. But at the same time, it's also developing the people who provide those support services. So it's looking at the Pursuit of Excellence program and making sure key programs like that are continued, enhanced, and further supported that provide professional development for the coaches. It's working with the professional groups to make sure that the service providers, they get some sense of professional development as well, but also making sure the NGBs feel connected and feel part, that they feel part of the Institute story and the success of their athletes over the longer term.
What are the special memories that you got from Paralympics over the years? What will be the standout memories?
Oh Lord,
you've mentioned loads through the hour.
I suppose the one thing that I've really felt privileged is really having a level of access to incredible athletes at their greatest or at their worst moments. And it's those back of house one-to-one engagements with some athletes have been just, I'll never forget when Gay Shelley, my great friend, who won his gold medal in Sydney. And Gay has an impairment that makes it very difficult to articulate his thoughts and his opinion. And he basically asked me to help him ring his mom home to tell her he'd won a gold medal. And I'll never forget, again, going up, there's no mobile phones those days, going up into the pay phone and putting in the phone card and ringing and talking and watching him, his face as he talked to his mother. And he said to his mother, I said, "Mom, remember when we were watching the Olympic Games in 1988 from Seoul? And I said to you, someday I'm going to win a gold medal for Ireland. And she goes, I do, yeah, I remember. I said, but you said, oh, well, I don't know, something that's never going to happen. Well, that's what's driven me to today. And as he's saying this to her mother, he's crying. And it's just, I'll never forget that moment, because I'm probably in tears myself at the time as well. It was phenomenal. I remember then as well with like John Fulham, who's the current vice president of Paralympics Ireland, like when his last race was in Athens 2004, and he'd expected to get to the final. I think it was the 200 metres T53 or T54 wheelchair race. But he didn't get to the final, so it basically meant that was it, his career was over. And I remember spending a good hour with him just in a room under the stand, just talking with him about his career and his thoughts and how he felt at the time. And he let me into a really critical moment in of his life, and that was wonderful. Or then just sitting down and having a cup of tea with Mark Rowan, I think it was probably at midnight, the day after his first gold medal in Brands Hatch. Me knowing that Mark, you have a race in 2 days' time, but he brought me through every corner of that race in great detail, and he was downloading everything that happened, probably the greatest day of his life. So it's those sort of moments, but it's the great people I've had a chance to work with, great people who've been on the board. The staff we have been phenomenal in terms of watching them develop, but also it's just seeing families and their reaction to athletic performance of their siblings or their sons or their daughters. There's so many memories, it's really hard to pull them together. But I suppose, for me, my overriding memory, I think, coming back from London as the chef de mission, we arrived in Dublin Airport and there was just, God, I don't know how many people there. And we just let the athletes out, they go. I just listened. I was back in the bag. I just listened to the roars. And to me, it was just, job done.
That's fantastic. The final question of the show is, if you had one thing to ask of the person listening to this interview, you could ask them to do one thing, what would it be?
What I would ask them is, we all know people who have some form of impairment, whether that be physical, intellectual. Encourage and support them. Just to be involved at whatever level they choose in physical activity. Because you never know where that could lead them to.
Perfect. On that note, we leave it there. Liam Harbison, CEO of Paralympics Ireland and soon to be director of the Irish Sport Institute. Thank you so much for spending the last hour with me. It's been a pleasure as always, and best of luck with your new role.
Thank you, Refnie.